We don't have an all-female host show today because Lubna is still recovering from an illness that everyone in Dubai seems to have got recently, one dose or another. Were you sick this year yet?
I actually haven't been, but
Okay.
that's mainly because I've been out of the country, so
Yeah, we're traveling. Yeah,
yes.
you avoided that as well.
I
So
did.
you're blessed,
I am,
Annika.
but let's not jinx it now.
No, let's always keep you well and healthy. So I will be hosting the show, talking to Annika. What are we going through today?
So today we're talking about how there are going to be no Ramadan price hikes because the ministry is stepping up to protect UAE consumers, and Dubai's $429 million parking IPO sells out in minutes.
In minutes, exactly. We'll talk about that. First, I've just come back from Riyadh. I was there until late yesterday. I attended, obviously, to work in our office in Augustus in Saudi, where we have Love in Riyadh, Love in Jeddah, Love in Saudi, and all that sort of stuff. And we're doing a lot of Snapchat shows this year. I was really excited about it, especially around Ramadan.
Of
So
course.
the team are getting ready to do all their Snap shows. We've got Ramadan stories, trend at Ramadan. If anyone's on Snapchat, they'll see all that. But the main reason I went is to attend the LEAP conference, which we'll get official numbers, but anywhere between 100,000 and 200,000 attendees.
Wow.
Lots of people talking about traffic, but the substance and the content of the event itself was a lot about investment, Annika, both from the announcing funds and announcing projects to those startups who have raised money. And I don't think we've long enough on this segment and this chat before we talk about the stories to talk about what's happening in Saudi and startup, but there's something happening, and
For
it's
sure.
I think it's going to be the story of a decade, as well as all the cultural and investments and giga projects and society changes. Like, the startup scene there is next level. We're going to have IPOs, from the Saudi apps that have got real big. Like, there's a Shopify in Saudi called Salah, and that's they've just announced hundreds more million dollars raised. We were trying to have a meeting with them. They're going to launch in GCC, they're going to launch in English, and they're going to go international. So they sort of, for many years, they were dominating in Saudi. So this is like every store, people, instead of making websites, are now using, as we know, Shopify. They're doing that, and they're doing that in Arabic and Saudi. And people are like, hey, why don't you go elsewhere? And they're like, the market's big enough here for us. So they dominated that market. And now, it really got Saudi online, right? Like, this is a country and a region who didn't have, who weren't really allowed to use credit cards online up until a few years ago. And now e-commerce is exploding, and also entrepreneurs managing their own web presence is exploding. So it's fascinating. And that's just one that they said they're going to IPO. And we have Jahaz, we have Hunger Station, we have so many more apps and utilities and so many things. And you can see the young people with their booths with all the ideas. Like, everything under the sun, there's a startup idea for. People say it's not that competitive yet. Wait 5 years and the markets will be saturated. But actually, like, I think there's already a lot of action there.
Yeah, Lubna and I were talking about this earlier. We spoke about how even people from the West are now suddenly coming here asking for investments. And previously, it used to be like, people from Saudi were funneling a lot of their money to the West and investing there. But now the investments are coming here. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I'll tell you two anecdotes, two funny stories. So a booth caught my eye. It was
Okay.
called, it was an orange logo. I'll search on my phone while I'm talking. And I went up to them and I was like, that's a really good idea, because it was around, like, it was something to do with the automotive industry. And basically there were four or five guys, and I was like, oh, where are you from? They're like American. I'm like, cool. So this is it. You won't really see, but basically it's called Karma, Carma, like the word karma, but also spelled car, backed by Y Combinator. You can see it's quite it's quite a punchy booth. And on the corner, we're raising Series A. So we're raising Series A and accepting KSA investors. So it's like, oh, that's a really good idea. So auto repair, maintenance, taking the pain out of your car maintenance, repair. So just on an app, like a CAFU for fixing repair, right? So I was like, that's going to work really well here. And they're like, oh, no, we're not launching in the region. I'm like, oh, why are you here? And they're like, because we want Saudi money to launch in the US. We want to get Middle Eastern investment to expand. So we want to give regional investors opportunities to invest in the Saudi market, then in the American market. And I was like, okay, cool, but like your brand's catchy, like, you know, it'll work here, karma, it'll work here. So, you know, then other people can come up with that. Another story, so we had, the venue was in a different area this year. Last year people complained about the traffic. It was in Riyadh Front. And this year it was in a place called, it was outside Riyadh, I'll get the name. And it was about an hour drive north of Riyadh.
Okay.
And the second morning we were with one of our colleagues in Riyadh, and he was driving, Ahmed, and Simon from the team here was with me. And we're halfway down the road, and a kind of a convoy, like a prince or someone VIP, was passing on the inner lane with sirens, right? And a car in front and a black GMC. And almost had an accident. And he stopped before going into the car in front of him. And then two cars went into us. When we stood in the middle of the road with camels on one side and loads of busy cars flying by us.
Okay.
I have my Starbucks coffee and my Leap badge, and three guys got out of the car from Bounty Hunter, a company in the US that helps freelance gigs, help people refer people to get jobs. And shout out to Chad who runs Bounty Hunter. So we had a business meeting in the middle of the road, right? And like,
what?
They were American, I'm European looking or whatever, and we were like it was dangerous. And we were waiting for the police to come and everything. So we were just having a business meeting on the way to Leap. Then
wow.
They got out of the car, they go, are you going to Leap? And then what happened was people were driving and they were shocked to see this scene, right? Because it was quite comical. And
yeah, camels, cars, business meeting.
Car
it really
crash,
sets
yeah.
the picture for
what
Saudi is going
right?
into.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I thought it was quite like, yeah. So, and then a couple of cars stopped as we were getting Ubers and Kareems and that. But people were so helpful. So one gentleman picked us up. He came, he grew up in Saudi, originally from Yemen. And he was telling us all about, he was like, I couldn't believe this scene in the middle of the road. It just caught my attention, you know. So luckily there was no more accidents. But yeah, so, you know, lots of anecdotes from Leap. Very exciting. Can't help but being inspired by what's happening
I
there.
Think that's my favorite thing about business here is how we are not just fully throwing ourselves into the money making, but we're also tying in culture, heritage, tradition, still being helpful, still picking up people on the roads, you know, still continuing with business meetings in like the most off settings. There's a lot to learn from the humanity angle.
You know, I totally agree. And, you know, we're coming up to the holy month of Ramadan, but I just think it's a theme that people are just helpful, right? Like you know, I had a meeting with a guy who is launching Semaphore in the region, and my team were like, oh, you shared a lot of information. And I'm like, yeah, like, it's not that competitive in terms of wanting other people to fail. It's competitive in the sense that there's competition because there's many offerings. But
right.
everyone kind of, I think there's a good, healthy, supportive ecosystem in the region.
Yeah, and speaking of healthy ecosystems in the region, take an example of our first story for today, which is how the ministry is stepping up to protect UAE consumers and like ensuring that there's a good tie between consumers and traders. Because for Ramadan, there are going to be no price hikes because the price of basic items like cooking oil, eggs and bread will not be raised without prior approval. Now, the goal for this is to basically protect consumer rights and ensure a balanced relationship between traders and consumers. So, and in fact, they're even looking to offer discounts of up to 50% on select items. So they're really going all out because Ramadan is a time when people love to buy in bulk, you know, buy a lot of products, especially the basic stuff to prepare food for iftar. But they're really going all out to make sure that prices are stable, no one's really affected. And I think that's a very great initiative. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, obviously, I think it's good to any help for people, you know, to avoid inflation or cost of living, and especially around Ramadan. However, I think sometimes, and I'm not sure how this technically works, but usually in an open economy, usually regulation at that level on price control isn't good because the supply and demand should dictate the prices and the cost of imports and the margins and things like that. That's a fair open market.
Right.
If you over-regulate pricing, imagine if you said price of property can't go up, and like a fair open market is the fundamentals of economics is supply and demand. So I think if there's shortage supply on food and the price go up, that's right. And then usually fiscal and monetary policies of governments, they have different, what they're called economic tools, they're called levers, and they can increase and decrease interest rates. And that's a fairer way to manage the cash in the country, and they can increase tax and things like that and manage their budgets, and they can offer other ways. But to price control, like imagine if there was something about school fees once where they were price controlling and it kind of opened a lot of debate. Imagine if it was decided that we can only charge certain posts for price for content, or in, do you know what I mean? I think there's ways to regulate advertising and businesses, and I think price control is a little bit, but maybe it's responding to something, and maybe there's been unnecessary increases over Ramadan on food. But again, going back to Leap, the prices of flights into Riyadh this week from Dubai were crazy, like 2-3 times, and the same with hotels in Riyadh. It went up, just like in Qatar last week at Web Summit, same thing. And if they regulated, if they said you can't increase your prices, the reason prices went up, Annika, is supply and demand, right? Like, more people want to go in, and then people can go, okay, if that's too expensive, I won't go. Therefore, it's not overcrowded in the hotels, you know? And I think also people need to be able to sell at times when there's high demand.
I know you're looking at it from the economic perspective.
Which is the only way to look at it.
No. I'm not going into the anti-capitalist solution. All I'm saying is, supply and demand, but like, what about that? What if the prices of commodities are increasing because everyone's
chocolate
waiting?
Chocolate prices have gone up. Did you see that? The cocoa bean, yeah.
Chocolate prices, onion prices.
Onion prices. Everything,
everything's going up. But what if people's salaries aren't increasing, you know? So,
That's inflation, right? Like, and that's
consumer
price index.
Yeah, and it doesn't inflation tie into supply and demand.
But what are you going to regulate? Are you going to where do you stop? Okay, so you've done Ramadan. Are you going to do chocolate now? Are you going to do onions? What about like flour? What about like, do you know what I mean? Like the different way, there are ways to control inflation and consumer price index, and that's increase interest rates, and eventually it comes down. Like the chairman of the Fed, Powell, yesterday said he's going to bring the rates down eventually this year. So, you know, that's what the US economy has been struggling at for a few years now,
right,
post-pandemic. And we're pegged to that interest rate, so it will come down. But the inflation hasn't been that bad here, you know, compared with the US.
But don't you think that's because of the policies we have in place? Or is it?
No, maybe it might be related to, I don't think we do many policies like the one-off Ramadan ones. I think the reason is because there's enough variety in products and custom and choice, right? Like, if and the flow of, we haven't had a shortage of goods. Like, Egypt has had a shortage of goods in certain commodities in certain space, and that kind of can cause inflation. But we haven't had, like, the UAE has done a good job in imports and exports. The tariffs haven't gone up too much and things like that. So, and the produce and the offerings to people. So that's why, like, inflation has many other factors, but they're more, there's macro and micro economic factors. I'm thinking back to my studies days, but I should know exactly what causes all these things. But yeah, just top line point is that this is a great initiative for Ramadan, and and hopefully that people, hopefully it curtails some, if there has been, what's the word? If there has been some
unnecessary.
Yeah. And what's like a taking advantage of the situation. And if that's controlling that, then great. But I wouldn't think a fair open economy should be controlled too much, like on pricing.
Okay, but let's jump into our next story, where I actually do believe in your whole idea of supply and demand, which is how the Dubai's $429 million parking IPO selling out in minutes. Now, that's something that has had a huge demand. So Parking Co. PJ, public joint sector company, the city's public parking operator, had their IPO open for a bit, and it was a resounding success, and it sold out as soon as the books opened.
Just to clarify a few things on this, so basically, just to set the scene, okay, so what we're having at the moment, Annika, is semi-state entities in the UAE, for the first time ever, are allowing retail investors buy shares, and they're allowing them to buy it before it opens, which is fascinating. It reminds me of loans for shares in Russia, mass privatization. of state assets. However, it's not full. Like, they're selling off some of it, but they're doing it on the local stock markets. There's three stock markets in the UAE. There's two in Dubai and one in Abu Dhabi, and the amount of companies that are listed on them improves liquidity, transparency, and offers people investment opportunities. This is the third subsidiary under the RTA.
Okay.
No one would have known the Parkin brand, P-A-R-K-I-N. We just know that we pay for parking for RTA. Mm-hmm. But what the RTA have done, some genius somewhere strategically has said, let's spin off Taxi, Dubai mm-hmm. Taxi. That IPO'd, that did well. Let's spin off Salik. That IPO'd, that did well. Now let's spin off parking. What I love about the parking IPO is that it's the zero competition in a growing city.
Right.
I thought the competition isn't even electric cars. It's only maybe flying taxis, but they'll probably find a way to park flying taxis somewhere and charge them in the sky, which is great. I love this stuff. Like, and they're going to pay of their profits. They're going to pay 100% dividend. So it was a 429 million IPO, of which that amount was committed in minutes. However, that you could still subscribe, right? So when this Bloomberg led with this headline, and we put it out too, but there was 2 or 3 days of a window, and after the few minutes, you can still put your cash in on ENBD. All you need is a DFM number.
Okay.
So you can still put your cash in. So that's not, if you put in 10,000 dirhams mm-hmm. and it's oversubscribed by 5 times,
okay.
then you'll get 2,000 shares, dirhams, and you'll get your 8,000 back into your account on the 29th of March when it goes public. And then you'll watch, did it pop or did it go down? And generally, when there's a demand and oversubscribed, generally it pops. Mm-hmm. So what you could be looking at, your 2,000 dirhams, and these are just really rough numbers,
right.
it could pop 20%, right? So your 2,000 dirhams can become 2,200, plus you get dividend, right. which is probably 6 to 10% yield. Maybe, I didn't read the full prospectus, but maybe every quarter or every 6 months or every year, right, of 100% profit of hundreds of millions of dirhams, right? So,
wow.
And you apply that strategy to all utility style. Now, okay. we're in a wave, right? We're in a wave of, like, you know, the first one was in the UAE was the ADNOC distribution about 4 or 5 years ago. But now we're in a wave of IPOs. And then the second wave will be and there's been a few already, will be the kind of big commercial companies mm-hmm. like Americano and like Virgil and a few companies like that. And there was another big one in Abu Dhabi recently. And then the third wave is going to be the kind of tech startup unicorny ones. So you've got your semi-state assets, which are great for dividends.
Right.
And then you've got your kind of company ones, which is like bonds. And then you've got your startup-y ones. Saudi seem to be leading the race for startups. ADX is trying to get a lot of people on board. But, you know, the big unicorns that we had in UAE, we're going to have our guest on today. You can ask him some of this stuff because Pure Harvest is surely heading that direction too, hopefully. And, so it's fascinating, this what's happening, really.
Wow, that's a lot of advice that I just got there. So are you saying, did you invest in it?
I did. I don't know how much I'm going to get back.
Okay. So do you think we can check back with you in a bit?
Yeah, let's talk about it. So the thing is, you only need a DFM number.
Right.
And you can go through your bank. You don't actually need a broker.
Yeah, I've seen that Emirates NBD offers that option where you just...
Yeah.
Go in, you make your investment account, and then you start.
Yeah, but you can't trade after. That's the thing.
Okay.
You have to either... I use BH Mubasher in Abu Dhabi, so I can trade after. But some of the... There's no Robinhood, and there's Barakah and apps like that, but they're only open to the US indexes and stocks.
Okay.
So we're waiting. And as soon as we have retail trading on apps in UAE, on these companies, but also... the unicorns and the techie ones when they go public, then Annika, you'll have more liquidity.
Okay.
There's a headline in the US today about Reddit going public. We've mm-hmm. talked about
yes.
it before. And on Reddit was famous for the meme stocks, GameStop, and ACM. cinemas and stuff like that. So, but basically, MC, so basically, you know, maybe we'll have a bit of, maybe people will hear of, not saying Love in Dubai would be the name of the company, but if Love in Dubai went public, mm-hmm. then maybe people would be excited to see the share price of Love in Dubai every day. Right. And I think we'll see a bit of that. If you, like Kareem and Uber, Kareem didn't go public, but like, if you have hero brands, the big one I'm personally waiting for, which we have zero commentary on, is Emirates. Because I think if Emirates IPO, which they, I think they will, I'll talk about it before, but we just heard reconfirmation that Etihad are going to IPO their airline in Abu Dhabi.
But something like Parkin, which has like a monopoly over the market, can you ever really run into a loss with something like that?
Yeah, it can be mismanaged. Of course you can. State assets are mismanaged in many countries. Like, name a country around the world who, this is the thing about the RTA, it's really well run.
Right.
Like, and they've been able to make divisions out of it. Show me, like, you can run into a loss on trams and metros mm-hmm. because they cost too much and they take too long. Mm. That's the same thing. You can, if you don't build an efficient parking system in the country, there's plenty of places around the world which people isn't regulated to charge for parking. People just throw their cars, right?
Right.
So that's the thing. They built something, a system that works, and it's
now they're
efficient.
Capitalizing on it.
Yeah.
Which is
now some. There was one comment on the post on Smashy Business saying, "Privatization is a disaster."
Yeah.
Read it.
This is going to backfire in so many ways. Privatization will make way for excess fines, charges, and many other frauds.
Yeah. So I think that's a negative way of looking at it. I mean, like obviously the thinking there is that they're in it to make money, but they're in it to make money anyway, in a way. But a lot of these funds go back into building more transport ecosystem and stuff like that. And that still will be the case.
Okay. Some very interesting
okay.
insights there. Thank you so much.
I think we have an exciting guest coming up.
We do.
It's Guy Kurtz from...
Guy Kurtz, the CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms. So we're going to learn a little bit about why things should taste the way they are.
Perfect. Okay.
Hello and welcome back to the Smashy Business Show. Today I am here with Sky Kurtz, the founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms. Kurtz is a leading figure in climate tech and ag tech. With his wealth of entrepreneurial experience and commitment to sustainability, Sky is shaping the future of food security from his base in Dubai, UAE. So, hello, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me a little bit about Pure Harvest. Why do you think things should taste like they should? I mean, I really love that tagline, but tell me a little bit about...
Well, first of all, we can't take credit for the tagline. It was an actual customer trying the product in a Carrefour one day that said this, that, gosh, this tastes like it should. And we thought, that has to stick. And it describes the need that we were filling. But Pure Harvest, we characterize ourselves as a technology-enabled agribusiness.
Okay.
We're not a tech company. We don't sell our technology.
Oh.
We actually sell or, you know, make money through selling fresh produce.
Right.
But we use technology to control the environment and make possible year-round, you know, locally grown, very high-quality and sustainably grown fresh produce. And we do that first in the UAE. We've expanded into Saudi Arabia. We're soon to build in both Kuwait and Singapore.
Wow.
And then we're looking at other markets to expand. So the company started with really just a pilot farm in Nahel in the United Arab Emirates, in the very center of the country, but proved our technology that we could control the environment and make possible this perfect climate for fresh produce. And then you can acquire seeds or genetics from anywhere in the world and literally grow anything. And of course, we started with tomatoes, but now we've expanded into many varieties of tomatoes, strawberries, blackberries, raspberries, leafy greens. And so we have a broad assortment available at most retailers in the UAE today.
I think it's very fascinating, the idea of creating fresh produce in the UAE. It's not a place, a desert is not the place you would think you would get the freshest tomatoes from. So this involves a lot of working with, like you mentioned, maintaining the climate. So, like, can you tell us a little bit more?
So maybe a bit of a backstory. When I first started this, I remember telling my wife's father about, hey, I'm going to leave. I used to be a technology investor. I worked in Silicon Valley, and I was a private equity investor at a leading technology and tech-enabled services-focused investment firm. So my background is in finance and in investments. But when I was saying, I'm going to leave this and I'm going to build a tomato company in the Middle East, literally, I remember my wife's father was like, he must have lost his mind. There must be a backstory there. Because the idea that I was not only saying I would build this, but that I believed we could be one of the most competitive places in the world in fresh produce production, once technology controlled for climate. And the reason why is if you think of the chemical process that is photosynthesis, making plants,
right.
It's sunlight, CO2, water, and nutrients.
Right.
Sun and CO2 are abundant here, right? So intuitively, sure. Two of the key elements of food production are abundant. But then if you go down the other side and say, what are the cost inputs to farming? Mm-hmm. It's light, whether artificial or natural sun, and we use natural light, labor, land, energy, water, taxation, transportation, capital. And if you go down that and you benchmark each one of those things versus, say, Europe, where we were buying a lot of our produce from,
right.
We have a massive, we have twice the light levels of, say, Holland. Energy costs are cheap and getting cheaper. We have powerful deflationary forces with the Emirates nuclear, with also utility-scale mm-hmm. solar deployments at 2 cents a kilowatt hour. Capital is abundant, low tax rates, competitive mm-hmm. labor rates, and can source labor from all over the world. If you now, you know, it quickly becomes apparent how once you have a technology that allows you to control for climate, which is, of course, the challenge here, all of the other variables are quite attractive. And now we've proven that in spades, right? We obviously, the first pilot farm was quite small and really just about technological feasibility and improving product market fit. Because a big guess was, no matter how successful the tomato production or product production was, one thing we didn't know is whether consumers would fundamentally believe in and buy a premium local offering. Historically, right. Before we entered the market, local production was often seen as maybe lower quality, right. Seasonal. The farming practices were uncertain, the use of pesticides, stuff like this. So we had a lot to overcome in establishing a brand and an identity as a very premium offering, but that is also, you know, sustainably grown, that also, of course, farms locally. And that was a big challenge. But ultimately, after the first build, we were quite successful. You know, ultimately, consumers love the product. We're extremely proud of the quality of our product. In fact, we won the Product of the Year Award. It's a Nielsen study of over 4,500 consumers. And we won it for the entire product range, which has never happened in the Product of the Year Awards. And it's now on our packaging. We also won what's called the Superior Taste Award. So you ship product to Belgium, and it's tested by, you know, 200 Michelin star chefs, and they blindly taste products and then rate them. And we won essentially the Michelin star of tomatoes, right? So we've proven that the product is extraordinary. We're really proud of that.
I love that you go the extra mile to really ensure the best quality. That's amazing. But just going back to how you mentioned that the UAE is actually an ideal place for, you know, this kind of investment. How would you describe the investment in sustainable agriculture?
Well, if I'm honest, early on it wasn't easy, right?
Okay.
We were, when I started Pure Harvest with my co-founders in 2017,
right.
We were still in the early days of this kind of entrepreneurial revolution that's happened here over the last many years. I mean, it's been wonderful to be part of and to watch. But even back then, Kareem was pretty young, right? This is long before their magnificent exit and et cetera. So it was really early days. And when I started pitching an asset-intensive, you know, capital-intensive agriculture technology onshore business competing against titans like Barakat and, you know, other businesses, it was not the easiest pitch, you know. And admittedly, we were even early in the narrative around food security, right? When Pure Harvest started, it was even before there was a Minister of State of Future Food Security, who was Her Excellency Miriam Al-Meheri. We were sort of early in that trend.
Okay.
And not that food security wasn't on the map for the country. The Abu Dhabi Agriculture and Food Safety Authority already existed, stuff like this. But it wasn't certainly the high-profile discussion it is today and has been at the COP summit, et cetera. So why I mention that context is early on, raising capital for this was tough. I thought, we have this technology, we can provide food security, water conservation, economic diversification, and sustainability all with one weapon. I thought this is going to be a big sell. And it was brutal. I mean, I was begging, borrowing, and stealing capital from all over the world. It took me 10 months to raise, what was around $3.9 million. We borrowed from the Mohammed bin Rashid Innovation Fund, which we were one of the earliest and the biggest loan they had ever done. And so I literally clustered together capital to get done the first build. Only after that were we able to access institutional capital and scale. And even then, that wasn't the easiest thing. There aren't many VC funds that can write $100 million checks here, right? It's just not the nature of our, and most of them are not interested in asset-intensive businesses. So we've raised capital all over the world. We've innovated a $50 million venture debt security, won awards for creating, literally had to create securities to meet our needs, which is not the easiest thing to do and not something I expected when I went on my tomato enterprise efforts. Another thing, though, is we've attracted capital from Korea, from IMM Investment, from London, from Metric Capital, Allion from Saudi Arabia. So we've been literally going all over the world to bring the capital to build this business because fundamentally we're building food infrastructure.
Right.
However, I think that the awareness of the potential globally and here has grown. And also, of course, now the company's maturity has grown considerably. We're able to invite both debt and equity capital. And, of course, we're sort of a capital deploying machine. In the end, we're building this food infrastructure to scale, and so we're always, you know, talking to investors about the next phase of expansion.
Lovely. So I'm just wondering. So you went to, you know, Korea, London, all of these like international countries, but did you have to deal with some weird stereotypes when it comes to like, you know, because you're literally pitching to them, we're going to create fresh produce in a desert.
Yes, a couple of things. First of all, I had people actually question, do these farms exist?
Yeah.
Now, I found out why. There's actually, unfortunately, a history of abuses. There was a company called Pegasus Agriculture, founded in the IFC many years ago, in 2017, 2018, that turned out to be a Ponzi scheme. It was a fraud.
Oh.
And so they were promising investors around the world, invest in a fractional ownership of a farm, and if you do so, we will... you'll get a guaranteed return, right? And I caution anyone listening, whenever you hear guaranteed return, run for the hills, because literally nothing but a U.S. Treasury is guaranteed, and even that these days we see is uncertain. So that said, they were out pitching this, and the thing fell over fabulously. Of course, lost hundreds of millions of dollars for investors. It was a total fraud and scheme. It also didn't help that while we were scaling up for institutional capital around the world, Abrash had its issues. And that was just unfortunate timing for us because it just led to distrust, right, and concern about governance. And when you're talking about huge amounts of capital, so yeah, there was a bit of stereotype / distrust, and certainly news around the world or news during that time didn't help us any. One benefit, though, I would say is, one, we founded the company both, we have a Cayman holding company, but also an Abu Dhabi Global Market Federal Free Zone company. And ADGM has put in place, as DIFC has, wonderful governance framework that people can understand and verify. I think that's one of the huge benefits of these federal free zones, right, and what they've done to make possible international capital access and governance. Mm-hmm. Also, because of some of the experience of our leadership, myself included, I'm obviously an American, but I've been on many boards in the United States and in other markets. Our chairman, David Scott, is on the board of huge companies around the world, including the nuclear utility here, Terra Power in the United States with Bill Gates. So we were able to, through the strength of our leadership, demonstrate, hey, these are people that really mean governance, the assets will exist, and also, of course, offering people to come tour and do diligence as they wish. But it was a challenge, and those unfortunate events that coincided with when we were scaling the business didn't make our lives easier. Wow. I would say, though, now that's certainly less a concern. Not only have we been, you know, prudent advisors and we've managed our fiduciary responsibilities well, but I think that others in the region are doing so too. There's a lot of other companies that have raised a lot of capital and who are doing good things with it. We just need to make sure there's less of those abuses or failures like Abraj and more of the successes like Kareem, and that would be good for the ecosystem.
So speaking of the ecosystem, your future, so is it true? Are you really planning to list on the Saudi?
on Saudi or UAE? The truth is, so like any company that takes private capital and scales a business, we owe our investors one day, and hopefully not too far away, an exit, right? A chance to realize their investment.
Right.
And that's certainly in our, we are thinking about that, and we're thinking about what is the right timing and the right scale. Mm-hmm. The company's, you know, transitioned to profitability, and we are now, every incremental project adds significantly to the company's scale and profitability because we've covered our fixed costs. We like to describe ourselves as really a self-funding platform where all of the intellectual property of the company, the management team, et cetera, are completely funded by existing operations, and the future of the company is entirely, each project is incrementally profitable. It's new infrastructure. Now, I say that we are thinking at one point that a public exit might be good for the company.
Right.
One, the health and vibrance of both the UAE and Saudi markets, the ADX and the Tadwul. But and really, I think you saw that last year, something like $500 billion of market cap value creation last year, attracting international attention. It's one of the healthiest markets in the world. I think also, and this was just discussed by Richard in the last segment, we could be a dividend payer, right? We're somebody who generates. In the end, what's unique about Peer Harvest, and this is, sorry, speaking to the investors and the tactical asset allocators out there, but for the first time ever with controlled environment agriculture, you can invest in ag without investing in land. We don't own the dirt. We lease our land because we can really grow anywhere. We grow in space, not in dirt, right? So we're building structures. We can be on a rooftop. We can be anywhere. So why do I say that? If you want to invest in this theme of you know, agriculture, consumption of fruits and vegetables, and which typically grows both with wealth and with populations, if you want to express that view, you can invest in a company like us where you get a branded, technology-enabled consumer staple without investing in dirt, right, in land. And that's a really unique risk pool that doesn't exist in asset, or hasn't existed really until recent years. The other benefit, of course, is that over time, we're transitioning the business to sort of being what we'd call an opco-propco, a management company that has the brands, the intellectual property, technology, designs, engineering, data, all of the IP of the company, and which is really a devco. It develops the assets, and then over time, the assets themselves can be financed by people who want to yield. So like real estate, you know, almost like a REIT structure or a sale-leaseback structure. And that over time is where we're going to go, right? I think that the assets, because they generate, once they're built, they generate cash, selling a consumer staple into retail and hotels, restaurants, catering, but selling food, which is really acyclical, even during COVID. I mean, one of the weird things about Peer Harvest and companies like ours is that sort of what's good for the world is good for our cost structure. If we get cheap solar power, it benefits our costs. Also, not using pesticides, they cost money. They're chemicals.
Yeah.
We don't need to use them, and therefore we save money, right? Mm. So there's that element. And then also there's an element of when there's a shock, a geopolitical event, COVID, anything, we benefit because we're locally or regionally producing, and we're able to have security of supply in during these you know, shocking geopolitical and other events. So I say that, that yes, we would be interested one day in a public listing. I think that the attributes of our business would lend well to that. And the final thing, Richard said this in the last segment too, having a consumer brand that consumers are buying every day and that they can see the performance of that and possibly invest in that, be a part owner in the produce they eat every day and feed to their kids. I think also people care about impact. We're a company that is really mission-focused, right? We care about sustainability. We care about creating a great environment and work environment. We even worked with the ministry to change rules to allow us to hire women for certain jobs we used to not be able to, because we're not, nobody's carrying rucksacks of, you know, minerals around in the dirt and the sun anymore in the way we farm. It's a beautiful environment with a controlled environment in a clean area, in great jobs, right? So we do a lot of stuff that people may not even realize, consumers may not realize, that when they're buying our produce, they're not only supporting a more sustainable future, but they're also really doing a lot of good locally, right, as we create jobs here and we create better opportunities for in the sector of agriculture.
So a pressing problem right now that the world is facing is climate change. So are you saying that something like climate change would not affect your company?
Well, if anything, it would benefit it, right? Because we are a solution for climate change. In a weird way, we've talked to people about this. A lot of people ask me, why did you start Peer Harvest in the United Arab Emirates of all places in the world? And there are several reasons. One, I think that we are a very acute representation of this global problem.
Right.
We have significant food insecurity. We import, you know, in produce, 85-90% of our fresh produce needs, because it's a perishable good, it's water intensive, and of course seasonally, 4 or 5 months of the year, people cannot farm here. There's just nothing. The farming they do here in lower tech farming is extremely water intensive and problematic, probably not sustainable, right? There are various studies published that the UAE has anywhere from 11 to 13 years left of groundwater. That's a national security issue.
Indeed.
And so why I mention this when in the light of climate change is that unfortunately climate change is making one, more irregular temperatures and higher temperatures, more extremes of humidity, droughts, et cetera. Mm-hmm. We literally are the extreme. Sadly, if the world continues on the path it's on, a lot more of the world will look like the Middle East. You know, water-starved, hot, humid, extreme climate environment, and that's what we solve, right? So in a weird way, we are a sort of a climate tech company, right? We ultimately provide a solution that allows you to produce year-round, and really decoupling the relationship of food production from climate and instead marrying it to energy and capital sources. And the more renewable those energy sources, the better our business model and the more that we're a true and tangible solution long-term for climate change, for feeding people in a world where climate change is, you know, omnipresent.
So, like, what would you say that your company's carbon footprint looks like?
Well, so right now we have assets across the United Arab Emirates, mm-hmm. all of which are in Al Ain, right? Okay. So we farm in Al Ain. Partly Al Ain has the most groundwater and water resources in the country, but also a more moderate climate slightly. It's a bit further from the coast.
Right, yeah, it's where the rain hits usually.
Yeah, where the rain, but also the humidity. People don't realize being next to the coast, of course, comes with it a perilous humidity, which only adds to the energy demands of cooling and dehumidification, which is bad for our CapEx and our cost structure and fundamentally for sustainability. Right. We want to minimize the energy consumption per unit of output, right?
Right.
So that's where a lot of our assets are in the country. We also are in Saudi Arabia, in Harad, and then we have now two assets. Last year, you may have seen announced, we acquired assets from Red Sea Farms, a Saudi mm-hmm. controlled environment ag business that was pivoting to be a pure play technology company. And we were assuming their operations there, which is a 6-hectare facility there. With that, we acquired the ability to utilize another 40 hectares of land. So we're scaling up considerably in Saudi Arabia now. And also in Kuwait, we've been exporting and partnered with a retailer in Kuwait called the Sultan Center, TSC. Okay. It's a premium retailer in Kuwait. And now we're looking to build a dedicated project which will supply that market. And then we are also building in Singapore. In fact, just yesterday morning, we took, this isn't even public yet, we took land from this Singaporean government. They provided us in a very unique process, which is quite rare in Singapore, a direct land allocation. And as part of that, we're building a pilot project there. And this project will demonstrate that in Singapore, which is extreme humidity, we can have year-round production of a locally grown fresh produce. Right now, Singapore is hugely dependent on China and on Malaysia for fresh produce imports, and that long-term is a food security concern. We want to demonstrate that they can produce locally year-round. And honestly, we're very proud of them partnering with us because they had their pick of technology partners from around the world.
Right.
Singapore is extremely sophisticated.
Right.
It was a long process. They sent a delegation here that included one of their ministers, studied our technology, studied our climate data, and said, this company is somebody who has proven they can produce in humidity levels that are even higher than anything we experience in Singapore.
Right.
The interesting thing about Singapore is they have average humidity that's very high, mm-hmm. but nothing like the extremes we witness. Right, August and September here is one of the harshest places in the whole planet.
Right.
And if you can keep a plant alive and productive in that environment, you can do it anywhere. And that was part of the origin story of Pure Harvest, is that we thought if we could prove this possibility here, over time, investors and governments and partners would see that this is a solution for anywhere in the world, whereas you can't go the other way around. If you're farming in San Francisco, it's a pretty nice climate. Nobody's going to believe you can build in the United Arab Emirates.
Wow, so Pure Harvest is really pioneering the idea of food security regardless of adverse challenges.
Well, I want to say we stand on the shoulder of giants, right? We're not the first to think of controlled environment ag. The Dutch are great at this. Canadians, Australians, there are many around the world. In Israel, Palestine, there's water and irrigation technologies that have been solving this for a long time. What's really unique about us is that we said, why isn't this being done in the harshest and hot, humid places in the world where all the sunlight is? When I was saying the sun, CO2, water, nutrients.
Yes.
If you think about it, where all the light is where all the food should be, like the rainforests.
Yeah.
Why isn't it? Well, the foods we like to eat like Mediterranean climates. And that's why seasonally we buy blueberries from Peru and then the next time Europe and all over the world. They all should be grown right in the middle, within 4,000 miles of the equator. Mm-hmm. Why isn't it? It's climate. So we thought if we could develop a technology that makes that possible, we can harness all that light and really localize production in this band around the world, which also happens to be where a lot of the world's population growth is. The Abu Dhabi Investment Office likes to promote, and they're correct, by 2100, roughly 80% of all human lives will live within a 12-hour flight of Abu Dhabi. And why is that? America and Canada flat to declining. South America flat. Two countries with population growth. China declining. Japan declining. Australia declining. The only growth in population in the world is the Middle East, Africa, and South Asia.
Right.
So if you play that forward 50, 100 years, in the end, we're in the business of filling bellies, right? Mm-hmm. Where are all the bellies going to be? They're going to be in this area. But the scary thing is that's an area that due to climate and due to water shortages, imports all of its produce.
Right.
So we saw that as a tectonic opportunity, right? One that we could, a 50-year investment theme, that we could build capacity, kind of skate to where the puck is headed, pardon the hockey analogy, but we kind of could head to where right. the world is going and build an enduring company that would, you know, its legacy would be that it contributes to that food security, to localizing production and creating job opportunities in these markets as we build. And that's why you see us not only looking at Morocco's like markets like Morocco and Tunisia, but also all the way to Korea. We see that building up, becoming the food production for the East is exciting. We still see opportunities also in the West in markets like Mexico and the United States. But right now our focus has been in this band, as I mentioned, this within 4,000 miles, where we have developed the ability to control climate and to build the construction tech necessary to make the system resilient, to have very high uptime in extreme operating conditions, because that's really unique about the markets that we operate in.
Wow. Well, that's fantastic. It was so fantastic that my earphone popped out. But, that's very insightful, and it's clear that you have a vision, you have a mission, you're on that path, and that's lovely. I think that's all the time we have, though, for today. So thank you so much. I was speaking to Skye Kurtz, the founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That's all we have for today. Make sure you catch us on podcast, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and also, of course, on YouTube. And subscribe to Smashy. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody.